You're hearing me? Everybody? Good, thank you. Okay, great. We had a little bit of trouble with some artifact on the sound, so if right now it sounds fine. So if we hear that again, we'll stop and ask people to mute when they're not speaking. So welcome, everyone. We've done this before. I think we're getting the hang of it, and I really appreciate each and every one of you for making time and making the effort to join us from wherever you are by way of Zoom. And I really want to give some gratitude to Doreen for getting us ready for these meetings and setting it up and helping us when we have technical difficulty. So thank you very much, Doreen. We really appreciate you for all your help and your technical support, too.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So a couple of things. I want to introduce Dr. Amy Gross. We can see her. She is with the Commission on Aging, and she's going to be visiting as a guest this evening. I'm going to go through and do, and I did want to just let you know who she was, so if you're wondering why she's here, and we're very happy to have you, Dr. Gross. And I'm going to go through and do a quick roll call, and then we might have a couple of other guests and or others on the phone, so I'll check that out in, as we go along. So I'll go down the list. So Chief John Brooks, I saw you.
There. I'm there.
Thank you. And if you're on the phone, when I call your name, would you just please say you're on the phone, because I that way I'll know that I'm not missing you. Joan Cayley.
I'm here.
Thank you. Thank you. Paul Childers.
Here.
Mark Collier.
Here.
Remy Youssef.
Here.
Adrian.
Here.
Thank you. Dave Fuller.
Here.
And Sharp Gort. Okay. Are you on the phone, Sharp? I'm not seeing you. Where am I? I see you now.
But I left my laptop at work, so I'm on an old clock, so it's a little slow.
Okay. I see you, though. It does sound a little sketchy, too. Okay. Katie is not going to be here tonight. And Dr. Neville, I don't see you. Is Dr. Neville with us? Let's see. Stephanie with us.
I'm here. I am on my phone as I'm still at work, and then we'll probably be driving in the car. So, but I will be listening in.
Thank you for joining us, Stephanie. John Roth?
I'm here, present.
Thank you. And Cassie? I saw you.
This is Cassie. I'm here.
Thank you for joining us. And Aru.
I'm here.
Great. All right. Then I think we might be having a couple of guests. Is there someone on the phone or that I'm just not seeing named Lauren Anderson? Perhaps not arrived yet. And Maria Alba Estrada? Okay, so not hearing from them, but they might possibly be joining us. And so I think we'll just go ahead and move on. Is there anyone that is at this meeting that is on the phone or on Zoom that I haven't named?
I didn't hear you say my name, Sandy Brown.
Oh, did I miss you, Sandy? Thank you. I saw you, so I just missed you. Okay, then let's just go ahead and move on. I would like to ask you, Dr. Gross, did you wish to speak at the meeting this evening? Okay. Well, then, very good. We're glad you're here. Thank you. All right. Then we'll go next to the formal approval of our minutes from the December 8th meeting. So hopefully folks have had a chance to look those minutes over, and I'll ask for a motion to approve the minutes.
I move to
approve. Oh, here, so
moved. Okay, I got Sandy first. So, Remy, can you second that?
I can second that.
Okay, then we're moved second, and the minutes are approved. Thank you. All right. The next thing that we're going to do is Doreen is going to talk with us about member vacancies. Thank you, Doreen.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen because I am a visual person, so I would like to see this while if somebody was telling it to me. So we're just going to go ahead and share the current vacancies that we have. We've been working over the last year on updating the process for the application and advertisement through the Board of Health, as well as those positions that are nominated. So just to go over really quickly with everybody, we have a vacancy currently with the Consumer of Public Health Services, and that is an advertised and selected position by the Board of Health. We also have a vacancy that is a representative from Clark County Social and Human Services Agency, which is also advertised and selected by the Board of Health. One of them is a non-elected representative of Clark County cities and towns other than the City of Vancouver, and that is a position that is nominated by city manager or mayors of Richfield, Le Centre, Yakult, Battleground, Camas, and Washougal. And then last but not least, a vacancy that is a representative of Legacy Hospital, which is nominated by Legacy Salmon Creek Hospital. And then John is on this list because I was going to go ahead and ask John to share what is new in his world and going on with his representation here with FAC.
Thank you, Doreen. Yeah, so I had reached out to Roxanne and talked a little bit with Doreen about kind of what I had going on. So I'm on my second term with FAC, and I'm also involved in some other groups. I was recently elected to chair the board of directors for the Pacific Northwest section of American Water Works, which is a 501c3. They operate in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. We have about 2,500 members, active members, and we do a lot of advocating for drinking water, clean water. We have a sciences work group, a business work group, management, water quality treatment, some of those different things. And it's a trade organization and a nonprofit that I've actually given quite a bit of time to. So it's going to be rather difficult for me to split my time between the two. It actually takes up quite a bit of time on that particular assignment, as you might expect. So I am going to not seek a third term. I'm just going to go ahead and let this term expire. That makes sense.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for letting us know what's going on with you, John. It sounds like it's a great opportunity what you're doing with, you know, the other organization, and we will miss you. But wish you the best on that. So when will you be having your last meeting with us?
Well, as I'm looking at this table, this handy table, because I'm also visual, Dory, this is fantastic. It says September of 22. So there's actually quite a little bit of time left here. I mean, it looks like it's over a year left on the term, which, again, it's fine. And I should share, I mean, I do have some colleagues that may have some interest in serving some employees with City of Vancouver. But if anyone knows of any other, you know, public water providers or water utility folks that may be interested, you know, I'm happy to reach out to folks or work with Roxanne to reach out to folks, because I think it's a great opportunity.
Great. Thank you for offering that, and I'm glad that we'll have you for a bit longer.
All righty, and then you might see Katie's name on here at the bottom, and unfortunately she couldn't be with us tonight. She should be here at our next meeting in April, but she is graduating this year. So would love for her to get to share her story at the next meeting, but she will have to end her term with us as she will no longer be a student/youth representative. So we'll work to get that position filled. And we wanted to share this with you this evening because our goal is to advertise for these vacancies, the top four vacancies that you see, within the next month or so. And we will let you know when those advertisements go out in case you have individuals that you know that might be the perfect fit. I'll go ahead and stop sharing at this point. Any questions, comments?
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Daryl. You have been absolutely critical to getting us organized, and I just wanted to share how appreciative I am of you and how you've organized this. So thank you again for all your help with this.
You guys are making me blush.
Good. Okay, well, then I think the next thing is I will, before we move on to public comment, and I don't think that we have anyone here that wishes to make a comment from the public, but I'll just do one last check on that. But I want to go quickly through the agenda, and so if there's any changes that I don't know about, we can get those in there. So we will be having department updates, and Jeff Harbison is not able to attend this evening. So my understanding is we won't have the budget update unless he handed off information to someone else on the staff. And it sounds like that didn't happen. So we will suspend that part of it. Janice will be presenting on the environmental public health update, in particular food establishment funding. And then we'll have the director's report, and it'll be all not totally about COVID-19, but there's an awful lot going on with that. So that will be a big part of the director's update, as well as letting us know what's going on with flu season, which we should be well into, but I don't think we are. So, and then we'll have the election of the executive committee members, and Dr. Melnick will be presiding over that. And Q&A after that. So before we move on to the department updates, I just want to reach out again and see if Lauren Anderson or Maria Alba Estrada have joined us by phone or by Zoom. And I'm not hearing any reply. So let's go right ahead with the, I believe you're next up, Janice, with the environmental public health presentation. Thank you.
Great. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a quick update on the financial relief for the food establishments through COVID funding, the CARES funding. So we did an initial round of funding, and the funding was not a fee replacement, but calculated how much financial support the food establishments or restaurants would get based on how much they paid for their 2019 permit. During the first round, we had 562 food establishments sign up, which was a dollar value of about $661,000. And we do have about 1,500 food establishments in the county, so we really felt like we wanted to do some more outreach. We got some feedback. Some food establishments were worried it was a loan, or they were worried that there was some other catch with it, and so some people didn't apply. So we took this update to the Clark County Council, and they asked us to do another round, that they would keep the funding available. It had to be done by the end of November. And so this time we had our food inspectors call all the food establishments that are eligible, and for those who had trouble with the online form or spoke English was a second language, they worked with them and went through the application with them, because it was a very short, easy thing to do, and they could just do it for them. So at the end of the second round, we had a total of 698 food establishments who had taken me the financial support at a total of $808,000. So it was very successful, and our safety manager, Bridget Bashaw, was really the one who pushed on this, provided a lot of leadership and made it happen. So very appreciative, and it was a great opportunity for them. The staff really liked to able to do something positive for the food establishments. We see owners as partners, but sometimes they don't feel that way as we're regulators. So it was a really good opportunity for them to have a much more positive experience with them. So that's it. Thank you.
thank you, Janice. That's great. Good report. And I think that we're next moving on to the director's report. I saw our director on TV last night, and it was a very good, brief little update.
Well, thank you. That must have been the KGW story.
It was.
So I'm going to just share my screen here and see if this works. Here we go.
Yeah, you did a great job, Doctor.
Well, thank you. Well, here we go. Can everybody see that okay?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, the topic on everybody's mind is what? COVID-19. So I'm going to take you through this. I'm just going to give you an update, basically, on a variety of topics related to COVID-19. And actually, I believe Roxanne will talk about wraparound services and isolation and quarantine. I'll do everything up to that. But, you know, we had the typical case numbers, a bump after the holidays. That's happening after every holiday. And it was... but we're far enough out that the number of cases are going down. So we averaged, 2 weeks ago was 95 cases per day, and the last week we averaged 60 cases per day. So so the daily case reports are going down as we get further away from the holidays. The activity rate, we also measure COVID-19 activity by the cases per 100,000 over 14 days. And in mid-January, we're at, and by the way, 350 per 100,000 is considered the high range. So we're at 474, so mid-January. And then the rate dropped below 350 the first week of February, and actually went down to 262 this week. And good news is hospitalizations for COVID-19 cases have started to decrease. So I can't help but be a Dr. Downer here. So the other point I'm going to make is, you know, I've come to, as I say, dread the holidays during the pandemic because of the small social gatherings that occur with eating and drinking and no masking. We can't mask while you're eating and no physical distancing or little of it. And I was feeling pretty good because there weren't any holidays on the horizon, or, you know, major holidays, until somebody pointed out, and how I could forget, that we just had Super Bowl Sunday, which is not really technically a holiday, but it's kind of an event where people get together in those small social gatherings and not only eat and drink, but also yell a lot. So I'm hopeful that we won't have a bump. But we'll be looking at it pretty closely through the month of February, and we'll see what happens. But I'm hoping that does not occur.
I'm glad we weren't in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, I guess if you saw the pictures from Tampa Bay,
chaos.
And it wasn't just people in the street, because you could see that in the films, but also reported people were in, you know, the bars and everything else in large
numbers. With no mask on.
Yeah. So hopefully that didn't happen around here, but as, you know, the problem with COVID-19 is it doesn't care, you know, it doesn't respect boundaries or political, you know, states or localities. It travels globally. So far in Clark County, we've had 17,610 cases. The number of active cases is basically people who are currently contagious. So they're still in isolation. That's what we mean by active cases. So 2 days before the onset of symptoms, and then basically 10 days after that. And then we consider them, if they've gone 10 days and their fever is resolved for 24 hours without fever-reducing medications and their symptoms are resolving, that's when they end isolation. So we currently have about 402 people in the county who fit that definition. We've had 203 deaths, with 182 of those confirmed. And I already mentioned the rate per 100,000. You can see we have 21 suspect deaths, And a confirmed death is basically COVID is listed, you know, when physicians fill out the death certificate, they list it as either a cause of death or a contributing factor, and then the person had to have had a positive COVID test. And a suspect death is it's not listed as a contributing factor, but also wasn't ruled out. And the person died after testing positive for COVID within 28 days. But if it is ruled out, for example, somebody gets hit by a car and dies, you know, that, you know, then it's kind of ruled out as a cause. But these are areas where it's not filled out on the death certificate and they had a positive test within the previous month. So that's where the deaths come from. These are currently the percent of hospital beds and ICU beds occupied. The percent hospital beds, we like that to be below 10%. It's at 11.2, but it's been dropping. So a PUI means a person's under investigation for COVID-19. So they haven't been quite diagnosed, but they're being worked up for that. These are the cases these are by lab collection date, but generally that happens, you know, soon, you know, while people are, you know, suspected of having COVID-19. So the bars on the graph are the cases per day reported by day, and then the line is a cumulative case count, and the steepness of the line reflects the number, you know, the increase in number of cases. And, you know, way back in April, you know, we got really concerned. We had some bumps there, but it's nothing compared to what we saw in, you know, November and more recently. And I think this graph illustrates that. So you might have heard about variants. And what happens, and this is why we really want to get the case numbers down, because the viruses tend to, this is a natural occurrence, viruses mutate. They reproduce, and every time they reproduce and make replicas of themselves, basically it's an opportunity for something, a change to happen in a genome. And they mutate. So the more viruses are around and the more they're replicating, statistically, the greater the likelihood of a variant emerging. So that's that's another reason for masking and physical distancing. Keep the number of infections down and keep the viral, you know, the community viral load, if we want to call it that, down. And multiple variants of the virus that caused COVID-19 have been documented in the United States and globally. And you might have heard the media attention of the variant from the United Kingdom, the B.1.1.7 variant. This isn't more lethal than the original COVID-19 strain, but it spreads more easily and it's more contagious. It spread the same way. It spread through, you know, through droplets through the air, and it's prevented the same way through masking and, you know, physical distancing, but it spreads more easily. And I guess the way I can illustrate that is it, you know, it takes, you know, if you're exposed, if you have the same exposure to two different people, one with the variant and one with the original strain, it's significantly more likely that the person, given the same exposure, is with the variant, is going to transmit the infection to you. It was first detected in September 2020, and it's highly prevalent in London and Southeast England, and it has been detected in Oregon and Washington, so it is here. And it may sound like good news that it doesn't cause severe illness as much. It doesn't cause any more severe illness, not the same as the original strain. But the fact that they're CDC estimates that this strain, because it'll crowd out others out, will become the dominant strain within a few months, and they're still being studied. And as I mentioned earlier, the prevention measures for the original strain also work against the variant. Spread the same way, just more effectively. Let's see. I press paper down and didn't do anything. Okay. So much for COVID-19 and COVID-19 activity. The next point I want to bring up is the new roadmap to recovery that you may have heard about, phase one and phase two. So on January 5th, the governor announced a new phased reopening plan called Healthy Washington Roadmap for Recovery, and it went into effect about a month ago. The state is divided into 8 regions, and Clark Kellogg's, Klickitat-Skamania, and Wakayakum are in the southwest region. The regions, not the counties, not the individual counties, but the measures, the metrics, need to be met by the entire region. So they're not, regardless of what Clark County's numbers are, the state is calculating the rate for the entire region. Obviously, close, because Clark County has the vast majority of the population, our numbers weigh heavily on what the region's numbers are going to be like. But all the counties in the region either advance to phase two or retreat back to phase one, depending on the metrics for the entire region. So as Clark County goes, so does Cowlitz or Wakayakum, Skamania, or Klickitat. The metrics related to the rate of COVID-19 in the community, as well as hospitalization trends, the occupancy in the ICU, and COVID-19 test positivity. As I mentioned, we advance as a region, so whatever happens here happens in Wakayakum. They're calculated every other Friday, so you're in a phase, not for a week, but 2 weeks at a time. So once you're in phase two, you stay there for 2 weeks. And if the numbers look bad in 2 weeks, then you go back to phase one and you're there for 2 weeks. You're there that length of time, at least. You have to meet, there's 4 metrics, and you have to meet 3 of the 4 to get to phase two. As of January 28th, 2 regions moved to phase two last week. That was Puget Sound and the western part of the state. The rest of the state, all of eastern Washington, all of northern Washington, and southwest Washington remain in phase one. And here's the metric. So this is, again, I showed you the numbers are decreasing more recently, but these are the numbers as of January 28th. The 14-day case rate was increasing, so we were not meeting that. And it doesn't look at the absolute number of cases per 100,000. It looks at whether it's increasing or decreasing, as you can see there. Same thing for hospital admissions. Then you see the average percent of ICU bed capacity. We're meeting that really well. We're not meeting the 7-day percentage of positive COVID-19 tests. So those are the tests that are done that are positive. So we're not meeting, as of January 28th, we're only meeting one of the metrics. You need to meet 3 of them. And I don't, the numbers will be reported out on Friday, I think it's the 12th, that's the 2 weeks. And that will determine whether we move to phase two. And the restrictions are greater in phase one than they are in phase two. And I don't have those in front of me, but you can go to the governor's website. And you could see, for example, in phase one, there's no indoor dining at all in restaurants. That's just an example. Okay, the vaccine. So let's get into the vaccine. So each week, the federal government allocates vaccine to the state for the following week. And you can go to healthcare facilities and pharmacies, request the amount of vaccine they would like to receive. We can provide some input on which facilities are priority. The State Health Department of Health, and by the way, we're registered as well. We're enrolled, so the Clark County Public Health and actually we're part of an incident management team with the with Calus and Skamania. We can request a vaccine as well. The State Department of Health looks at these requests and looks at the amount of vaccine coming from the federal government, and then decides to allocate how to divide vaccine across the state. Right now, I mean, the main limiting factor in getting people vaccinated is a vaccine supply. And as you can see, there were 358,000, there was a request from across the state for 358,000 first doses, and 107,000 went out. And so you can see that the request or the demand and or the capacity to vaccinate people, because that's why people would be asking for that amount, way exceeds the amount of vaccine that's available. So generally the requests go in on Monday, and then at the end of the week, you find out how much you can expect for the next week. And then maybe, and then it gets delivered, I believe, on Monday or Tuesday the following week. You may get less than you requested. You may get what you requested. It may be less, or you may not get any at all. So you find out on Friday, and just a few days later, you get the vaccine. Because facilities do not always know how much vaccine they're getting, they're not going to book appointments for people too far in advance, because you don't want to have an appointment for somebody and then not have vaccine to give them. And because you have to reschedule or cancel, it makes it really difficult. There's the limited vaccine supply and unpredictable nature, not knowing how much you're going to get. Makes it challenging. This will get better, once we have a ton of vaccine available, a whole lot of it available, and we're not in this shortage state, this will get better. But right now, and for the foreseeable future, that's where we're at. And, one of the concerns is, you have to give the second doses. So, if it's the Pfizer vaccine, that's it for the, I got concern from some of the providers when they received less vaccine, for example, last week and this week, is they were not scheduling people for first doses because they were concerned that they needed to have to finish the series. Okay. Let's see. I want to just look through here to see if I. Okay, I do have the referral process. So I want to make sure I covered that. So, early on this, and this goes back to, and if I'm going on too long and people want to ask questions, I'm happy to stop because I know I'm giving kind of a monologue. I'm getting tired of listening to myself speak myself, so I'm just wondering whether anybody else is, but I'm happy to keep going. Okay, I'll keep going. Actually, New Year's Eve, we actually put in our application for a Type 1 incident management team. It became clear to us that, especially once the vaccine, we wanted to get as much vaccine into as many people's arms as we could, as quickly as we possibly could. And we realized it would be a massive undertaking that requires a lot of coordination. So we joined with Calix and Skamania Counties with support from the State Emergency Management Division. They support an application for us to get an incident management team, a Type 1 team, and it's called PNW3, I think it's Pacific Northwest 3. It's one of 16 Type 1 incident management teams in the United States, and FEMA approved the request and is supported deployment here. And the reason for that, you might recall back in those of you around back in the H1N1 days, we used an incident management team to vaccinate folks back in the, that was I believe 2010, so 11 years ago. We also went into incident command for our measles outbreak. And then we also did it a few years ago when we had that hepatitis C issue with East Health, and we're actually in joint incident command around that. When you have a complex event and you need to coordinate, and you have some, it provides you some command and control to get. It's basically like herding cats in a way, making sure that you're well organized in your response. And this is a pretty complex event. Actually, we had to do what's called a complexity analysis. And based on the complexity analysis, we qualified for the highest level team. And we continue to work with the incident management team. Actually, there's a transition. We have a new team coming in. We're opening vaccination sites throughout the three-county region. And we're planning on not just those stand-up fixed, pods or points of distribution, not just those megapods that you might have seen, but we're also planning on mobile vaccination sites because we're clear that we need to bring the vaccine to people, not just have people travel to a central site to get the vaccine. Many communities that have been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19, particularly communities of color, will have less access to some of these standalone sites. And we really want, and including critical workers in congregate setting, like some of the food production plants, we realized that we needed to be able to get vaccine to populations that we felt have less access, have been more impacted by the pandemic, and felt we needed to make sure that those populations were covered. So we're working on that. And I can explain a little bit more as we talk. Well, I'm going to get into it right now. So we did set up a fixed location site in Skamania County Fairgrounds on late January. And that one-day event vaccinated more than 250 people. One of the concerns we had here in both Clark and Calhoun County, actually, I just mentioned Clark because I'll mention both, but I want to point out that Clark County has the highest number of adult family homes per capita of any county in the state. We have close to 400 adult family homes. Adult family homes are long-term care facilities with 6 or fewer residents. So you might recall that one of the priority populations was the long-term care facilities, like skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities.
And actually, adult family homes are included in those. Those are the highest, you know, in the highest priority group for getting both residents and staff vaccinated. Many of those, or most of the larger facilities, like the skilled nursing facilities and the assisted living facilities, were received vaccine through this pharmacy program involving CVS and Walgreens, where those pharmacies got the vaccine directly, and they went out and vaccinated residents and staff of these facilities. But we were, the facilities had to enroll in that program, and many adult family homes did not enroll in that program. In fact, 260 of them did not enroll in that program, and therefore their residents and staff were not vaccinated. So we had this incident management team in place. We thought that doing some mobile teams would be able to reach that population. So we actually last Thursday and Friday, on 2 days, we actually sent out mobile teams and vaccinated 930 people in adult family homes, staff and residents, and we reached 130 of them. There are also some other long-term care facilities that we were able to provide vaccination in as well. And we, besides our staff, we also had 50 volunteers from Medical Reserve Corps and Clark Hallett's Fire and Rescue. And one thing I do want to mention that we didn't put in our, you know, we put out a news release about this, but it made me feel really, brought tears to my eyes, is that at one of the adult family homes, as the fire folks were leaving, the residents applauded them for getting the vaccine. So we really want to make sure that population is covered. We're also looking at additional sites, these smaller, you know, including mobile sites where we can basically reach populations that, as I mentioned earlier, that are most affected by the pandemic. For example, I'll just give you a couple of examples. One is, you know, we want to set up sites at schools. But if we set up sites at schools, we can actually, depending on the schools, we can also immunize critical populations that are near the schools. Schools are trusted sites that people go to. For example, in Calhous County, if we were to provide immunizations, for example, at the Kelso School District, we could probably open up vaccinations to people, workers at Foster Farms, which has a large population of workers who are a Pacific Islander population. So that would be an opportunity to reach a critical population. Likewise, you know, we've talked with community partners. If we were for example, provide immunizations at in an area where there are Title I schools, we could provide immunizations to the surrounding neighborhood as well, where we're more likely to be able to immunize communities of color. So we're looking at that as well. There is some, you know, information and literature that, you know, vaccination efforts so far around the country have failed to reach those communities. And we have an opportunity to, you know, with these mobile pods, we get good at doing them, we'll be able to do that. So equity is a big concern for our vaccination efforts.
Hey, Dr. Melnick, sorry to interrupt, but Cassie raised her hand, so she may have a question for you.
Sorry, Cassie, go for it. I can't see the hands raised, so thank you, Doreen.
No, I appreciate it. I'm at work, and I just had a question. You talked about volunteers. One thing I noticed, like, as a nurse here, like, I've been doing COVID for a year, is there's a huge population of nurses that would be happy to come volunteer, but have no way of, like, knowing what they should do or where to sign up or any of those things. So just a thought. I didn't know if nurses in the community could volunteer. How would they get that information? Because I'm a great shot giver, and I'd love to come volunteer to give shots somewhere. I'm only working my part-time shifts because the hospital is really rough. I pick up occasionally when it's really bad, which has been really bad. But just some thoughts of a way that, you know, maybe we could give back to the community and volunteer. So just a thought.
I think that's great. I'm glad you brought that up. So after the first limiting factor in getting people vaccinated is the vaccine supply. The next limiting factor in terms of getting people vaccinated is the people who actually stick the needles in the arms and do the vaccination. So identifying some nurses who are, I know with the school districts have offered 80 school nurses to help with the vaccinations. But Cassie, if you've got some folks, some names or contacts, nurses are in high demand for doing this effort. So definitely appreciate that.
Do we email you, or where would, I work in Oregon. I don't have a Washington license, but I have a current Oregon license. So I just don't know.
Yeah, I'll talk to my team about that. I don't know about the cross state. Roxanne?
What I was going to say is that as part of our incident management team, we're standing up a volunteer coordinator. So we're getting it together right now so we can capture everyone who wants to volunteer in a specific area. Criteria. Cassie, if you have folks that you know of, and if you want to email me, I'll put my email information in the chat box.
I know a ton of nurses.
Absolutely.
Who would come volunteer, but nobody has reached out. I mean, I work at Emmanuel. Like, they would love to come and give shots and help out, and nobody knows how. We're an untapped resource that is just feeling like, you know, I know that they're trying to cut the red tape and everything. So, I mean, I'm literally at work, so, and there's lots of people who would love to help. So just some food for thought, and I guess, Dr. Melnick, put my name on that list, because on my time off, I'd love to come be safe, socially distanced, and I have a half mask and all the things, and I'd love to help.
Well, that's great. We're getting that together, so we will definitely get back to you, Cassie, because that's a big need. So.
Thank you very much.
Roxanne, did you have anything you wanted to add, or...
No, I've got, we are setting up the volunteer coordinator right now and putting together the criteria for capturing all the names and the callbacks for everyone. So, Cassie, I'll send your name over to that team for contact. And then I also put my email in the chat box, so if anybody else would like to send any information for potential volunteers, I can certainly help to coordinate that with the incident command team.
And this is good timing, Cassie, because right now, I mean, for example, we asked for 1,000 doses last week, and we didn't get any for this week. So, so the vaccine supply is still short, so we may get you and your colleagues signed up just in time when we have more vaccine. We can do some more of these mobile pods. It also relates to when the, you know, when the governor opens it up to the next group, essential workers as well. But I think we may be able to get folks, you know, the timing on this is really good. I know you haven't been asked yet, but as the vaccine supply increases, we're going to need more people to do that. Then the limiting factor. Right now, the limiting factor is vaccine supply. The next thing, once the vaccine supply is large, we need enough people to give the shots. So...
Yeah, I can tell you, Dr. Melnick, vaccinating those workers at Foster Farm would be a really good idea. And the feedback from the Indigenous community and communities of color are most of them are really excited and fighting to get the vaccine. We have the Moderna at Cowlin, and we're vaccinating intergenerational families, including non-Native or non-enrolled partners, and so we're really trying to blanket the community, and we've had huge amount of people coming. We've had people driving from Idaho, from Southern California, from all over, so there's a large population of your inequity people that are looking for that, and they'll be excited to hear that you're wanting to meet those needs, so thank you.
Yeah, if you look at how the vaccine rollout has been going on so far, I know we're, 2 months, a month and a half or whatever into it. Those communities have been excluded, and what's really tragic about that, they're also communities that are most impacted by the pandemic. So I think we have an obligation to try to not make the same mistakes that have been made elsewhere.
No, and I appreciate that, and the tribes appreciate that, and it feels like a new thing, and so we appreciate that warm handhold and the caring, and we're trying to pass that along also. So thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Any other questions? I don't know if there was, Doreen, is there any others up there? No?
No hands raised.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're aware of the state vaccination site at the Clark County Fairgrounds. This is a Department of Health site, and it's by appointment only. And the registration for appointments opens at noon on Sunday. And the appointments fill up really quickly. You need to get in really early on that. And they're scheduled, as you can see, Tuesday to Friday from 9 to 5 and 9 to 3 on Saturday. The site opened January 26th, and so far they've administered 6,702 doses. When people are having difficulties with the scheduling there, we've been directing them to call. There's a number that the state has, and there's also a point of contact. And these numbers are available on our website, by the way, for Safeway Albertsons they're partnering with the state in terms of this pod. So we do not have access to the scheduling system. We've heard from folks who, the demand is huge. So if you don't get in right away to register, you'll get there's a message that, there are no appointments available. So we can't, and if people aren't sure whether they have an appointment or not, we don't have that information. But on our website, and we can give out information as well, numbers that people can call. So that's one process for people to get vaccinated. The other process is that we've had this up for a while, they can go through us. And up till now, we've had a portal available on our website. People would go to the website. There's a form they can fill out, and we could refer. We've been working at getting people appointments at our healthcare providers. Who have appointments available, and to date, we've referred more than 7,500 people through the process, but there are currently about 35,000 pending referrals on there. And, you might remember the numbers I showed you a couple of slides ago, the amount of vaccine that's being delivered and the amount of doses that are given. If you look at the 65 and older population in Clark County alone, that's 89,000 people, just that group alone. So we currently have about 35,000 people who've registered through our website that are waiting for appointments. And the other problem is that the health facilities, already mentioned, have received limited or no vaccine over the last few weeks. So that's why people are waiting in the queue, and that number keeps on increasing. A real limited vaccine supply. The other point I want to make is that, and I don't know if it's the next slide or not, we're concerned, we understand that having people use the internet to make appointments is basically keeping folks who don't have internet access, who don't use the internet access, preventing them from getting access to appointments. So we will be standing up a phone bank, a phone system, and a phone number to make that available by phone. And we will have capabilities in multiple languages through that phone bank. And Roxanne has more information on that if there are questions that I can't answer. Let's see. Oh, wrong way. Let's see which way I'm going here. Okay. Okay, that's it for the vaccine appointments. But like I said, it's right now the main limiting factor is vaccine supply. Okay, I think this might be the last piece is our community testing site. One of the things we heard is that there were barriers to testing people getting tested for COVID-19 in the community. So there was an opportunity to partner with the State Department of Health, City of Vancouver, and PRESA to open a free testing site in the Tower Mall in central Vancouver. It's on Mill Plain Boulevard. And there's access, public transit access. And we recommended this for anybody 4 years of age and older who had symptoms of COVID-19 or who was exposed to someone who tested positive for COVID-19. So exposure or symptoms. And the testing site is open Tuesday through Saturday. You can either drive up or walk up. It's painless because it's you actually when the people working there will hand you a kit where you actually swab your own the inside of your mouth and then put it in the specimen container and hand it back. So it's not one of those nasopharyngeal swabs. It's pretty quick, takes about 20 minutes, and the results in 3 days. It goes to a lab. It's a PCR test, so it's a good test. There have been issues with false negatives, which is why we're basically think it's best for people who are either exposed or have symptoms. It's free for everyone. It doesn't matter whether you have if you have insurance. Certainly, they will ask for insurance coverage. But if you don't have insurance, there's no fee. There's no test fee. There's no visit fee. And it doesn't matter your immigration status. Whether you have documents or not does not matter. This is no barrier testing, but we do encourage people to register ahead of time to make the process faster. We opened the site to the public January 12th. We've administered close to 4,200 tests, an average of about 1,000 per week. We've actually identified 482 people who tested positive, which is a 12% positivity, and those could be people who, who, if we didn't have this no barrier testing site, might not have been able to identify that they had COVID-19, which is really important if you want to, control the pandemic. It's identifying people who are positive and making sure they're able to isolate and you can provide them support during isolation, as well as provide support in quarantine for their close contacts. The highest single day was January 12th. So that's it for my COVID-19 update. I think Roxanne's going to handle the wraparound services and give you more information about isolation and quarantine. I don't know if anybody has any other questions.
Dr. Melnick, I have a question.
Yeah.
I kind of had a couple things, but I held them to the end. I'm going back now to where we have concern about a bump from Super Bowl. Coming up pretty soon is Mardi Gras. Is that something that we would expect we might have the kind of activity around here that could become a problem there?
Are you trying to cheer me up or what? by the way, I love holidays. I love all this stuff. I don't know. I think we need to continue to get the message out that we're not at the pandemic is still going on. I know it sounds horrible, but it's going to take a while. It won't be, to have herd immunity, you need to have about 70% of the population vaccinated. In Clark County, that's 350,000 people, and we're less than 10% of the way there. So I mean, and now we have the variants in Western Washington. So. I am concerned I understand that people want to get together and do these things, but if we can hang in there for just a few more months, you know, several more months, and get through this and get, you know, the vaccine into people's arms, I'm hopeful we can open up again. Yeah, and then, you know, we got Mardi Gras, we got St. Paddy's Day, you know, I can think of a whole bunch of things that are, you know, coming up that, you know, and especially when you add eating together with drinking, you know, with eating, the masks come off. Hopefully you had them on before that. Drinking, people, you know, you lose your inhibitions and all that. And then, you know, you got singing, which gets more droplets into the air. Those are the things that keep up at night. Sorry.
Well, thanks for that. I have two questions about the UK variant. One is, speaking of droplets in the air, is there something about the UK variant that where people produce a finer droplet, so it's more airborne, or is it just something within it that's not?
Yeah, it's something within it. It's the mode of transmission is basically the same. It's just that this virus has ability, I guess, you know, greater ability to latch on, you know, once you're exposed.
Okay, and then my last.
Yeah.
Well, that the last one is, I think I heard you say that the UK variant seems to be responding to the vaccines that we currently have.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I didn't say that, but I'm glad you raised that question. I think I neglected that. Or maybe I did. I can't remember. I said so much. But yes, it looks like the, you know, it is responding to the, it will respond to those vaccines. Yes.
Thank you. That's all my questions.
But that's even more reason to get vaccination, you know, to keep the numbers down, because a new variant emerges that could be resistant. So more reason to get people vaccinated pretty quickly.
Hey, Alan, what about, did you already talk about the South African variant? That one sounds a little bit more worrisome with the vaccinations maybe not being as effective. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, I haven't heard that. There may be. I'll get back to you on that, Adrian. I don't know how much data that is available on that, but, you know, it's certainly concerning.
Okay.
I know that there was some talk that the one dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine has a somewhat lower efficacy. And the concern was that it was tested in a population that had, you know, different exposure to other variants. And not me, I'm scratching my head right now to understand whether there's the South African variant or not. But right now, I mean, I strongly recommend people get the, you know, the vaccine. From what I know, the vaccines are still effective.
This is Paul.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to, an FYI, Governor Brown has loosened up some of the restrictions today in fact, it's going to be effective as of Friday, and
occupancy as well, but you're absolutely correct. Challenges being a border county when you have different rules and phases and all that. You might notice that a week or so ago, people were from Oregon were coming up to the state pod and at the fairgrounds, even though they did not live or work here. And the state had to get some messaging out basically saying this is for, you know, people who live and work in Washington. But yeah, there's always issues on being a border county when you have different rules and regulations from one state to the other. And I just want to get back to the South Africa. From what I know, Adrian, I believe that the vaccines are still effective. So I want people to continue taking them. I hear
Dr. Melnick?
Yes.
This is Cassie. I heard in, we have Gov meetings and we have IHS meetings and things like that. Isn't it that the Pfizer is the most effective at 96 and Moderna's 94 or 92, and then Johnson & Johnson 67, and they tested it in different places, and unfortunately because of the Ebola or things like that, they feel like that one isn't effective in South Africa at like 20%, but in the U.S. it's higher, and they're thinking it still might be an okay choice even though it's lower. But and then the Novavax is even lower than Johnson & Johnson, just so that's all I know. Thank you.
Yeah, so the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, I mean, 94-95% effectiveness is really high. That's higher, you know, for example, the flu vaccine, you know, depending on the year, ranges from 40-60%. So that's really high. In terms of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I believe that it was really highly effective, a lot higher than the, I can't remember the number, maybe it was, if I remember correctly, again, this is off the top of my head, that it was highly effective in preventing deaths. And I shouldn't say this, but if I recall correctly, there may have not been any deaths in the group that received it, but I can't remember that for sure. I just know that in terms of mortality, and I believe even for severe complications, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was highly effective. I think that, you know, the 94-95% or so effective with Pfizer and Moderna include symptoms as well as complications and deaths.
This is Paul. The Johnson & Johnson said that it wasn't nearly, the efficacy was not nearly as effective. However, of all the cases that they are, all the people that they had used, no one had died and no one had gone to the hospital. It kept you out of the hospital and it kept you from dying. But you would get sick. You would still have the COVID, but kept you from dying and kept you from going to the hospital.
You just nailed it, Paul. That was what I was remembering off the top of my head, but you apparently just looked it up. But yeah, it was highly effective in terms of death and severe complications. Yep.
Yes.
You know, the other thing about the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine is, and this is why we're going to be masking and physically distancing for a while, they do prevent people from developing symptoms. They're very effective in preventing people from developing symptoms. But what we don't know is whether they prevent infection. And if you do get infected, you know, theoretically you can still transmit the infection. So we don't know that about the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. I could talk about vaccines all the time. Any other questions?
I just want to say that I appreciate all your work, and public health doesn't shine the way that it should, and I appreciate your tenacity and all your efforts and your warm hand-holding and your kindness to the tribes and kindness to all the communities of color and the fact that equity is important to you. And I just really appreciate that. So I just thought I would take the time to say that because people don't get thanked enough, especially during a pandemic. So thank you, Dr. Melnick.
Yeah, Thank you, Cassie. And, you know, I want to be also held accountable. You know, I'm saying this, but we really need to get that job done and make sure we reach those populations. So we're going to be working hard on that. And I want to be able to, I think it'll be really successful if we're able to do what we're intending to do. But really, thank you for your support for public health. Really appreciate it. So, are there other questions? Or, Roxanne, do you want to get into the wraparound?
I can talk about isolation, quarantine, and wraparound services. I think you can stop sharing your screen, Dr. Malik.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No worries.
There you go.
And I don't have any slides, so I'll run through this pretty quickly. One of the things I did want to, before I talk about isolation and quarantine and wraparound services, I wanted to just give you a quick update. Dr. Melnick mentioned the phone day. We actually have a call center that went live for a soft launch on Monday this week. And Monday and Tuesday, we were actually working on it to work out all the bugs. And it's due to go live to the community, to the public tomorrow. There's an 800 number that's public facing. And the thing I like so much about this call center is that not only is it staffed with a lot of people, so the likelihood that you're going to actually be able to talk to a human being is much greater now than it has been in the past with public health. Second thing is that we've got several people that speak a variety of different languages. So we have Spanish-speaking call center folks. We have Russian and Ukrainian-speaking. We have different Pacific Islander languages, Chukis, and there were a couple of other Marshall Islander languages, and I can't remember off the top of my head what those were. French, actually, and German and Vietnamese. So we're really looking at making sure that when somebody calls in, they can actually get a team, you know, go to a team that can speak to people in their native languages as much as we can. And we do have set up where we can get some additional translation if needed, if there's a language somebody is calling in that we don't speak on our team. But we're hoping that that will be few and far between. The other good thing about this is that with our soft opening on Monday, we've started tracking the calls that we're getting and some of the demographics, which are great. And what we've been able to tell is that, you know, as we're helping people not just answer questions, but also sign up for the wait list. Dr. Melnick mentioned that there's a lot of folks that may not have internet access, and so that's inherently inequitable. The way we've had it set up. And so what we're able to do is we're able to help people when they call in to actually fill the form out for them. And as of the last couple of days, about 30% of the folks that have called in are requesting assistance with the form. And all but just a couple of them were age 65 and older. So we'll also be getting some additional data as we move forward. But I just wanted to share that with you. So I'm excited that's actually launching to the public tomorrow. There'll be a news release that goes out in the either tonight or tomorrow morning on that. So I wanted to share that, which is great news. I'll start with isolation and quarantine. One of the things that we were doing for our case and contact investigation work was that when we have a positive case or somebody that has been exposed, a close exposure, we were asking them to isolate and quarantine for a period of time. But in order to do that, we had, you know, some people could isolate and quarantine in their own homes, but sometimes they can't for a variety of reasons. Either, you know, there's not enough space in their house, you know, there's multiple generations in a household, that sort of thing. And so we had been working with Department of Community Services, who had a hotel off of Chocolog. And that was available for people that needed housing to for their isolation and quarantine period. And the funding for that hotel actually ran out by the end of last year. And so Department of Community Services had that facility actually ended up closing. However, Public Health was able to get some additional funding, and we were able to contract with Counselor for the Homeless for isolation and quarantine for people that are houses are experiencing housing insecurity and things like that. So we've been able to contract with them, and they are setting up a variety of different locations for people to go and continue to isolate and quarantine. So we're really excited to be able to continue that, because it's so critically important to make sure that we keep that, the viral load in the community down. And so we really wanted to call out Kate Budd and how wonderful she's been as a partner to public health. And the work she's doing around the isolation and quarantine facilities is just fantastic. So that we're very happy to continue. The other thing that we were doing is, part of being in isolation and quarantine is, we want to help folks that, with things that they need so that they can stay in isolation or quarantine, during the period where they've been exposed or they need they're in an isolation period. And sometimes that includes, groceries, grocery delivery. Sometimes that includes, they need their prescriptions picked up and delivered. Sometimes it actually includes rental assistance. They need us to pay their rent, their mortgage payment. They need us to pay their utility bills. So we have funding to be able to provide those services, not only to, pick up and deliver groceries, but actually to buy groceries for people, to pay for their mortgage, to pay for their rent during this period of time. But the problem with the funding that we had is that it only paid for those services while people were in isolation and quarantine. And as we know, just because you get your rent paid for a month does not mean that, that automatically clears up all the issues going forward. And so one of the challenges we had was, how do we work with our community partners for folks that had ongoing needs outside of isolation and quarantine? So two things happened. Number one, we lost funding at the end of last year for wraparound services. So that was number one. Number two, we were able to identify an additional funding source LHJ did not apply for it, but our partner who could provide not only those wraparound services for when people are in isolation and quarantine, but also continue on to provide services after isolation and quarantine were over. And we were able to work with Southwest Accountable Community of Health. They have a system set up called the Care Coordination System, which had already been stood up. And they had a variety of different partners that they're working with: Vancouver Housing, Council for Homeless, Food Bank, Meals on Wheels, a variety of different organizations, where not only can they provide services for when people are in isolation and quarantine, but then they can also continue those services once that isolation and quarantine is up. So we've identified a funding stream to pay for the isolation and quarantine wraparound services, and then Swatch was able to continue those services with other funding sources for ongoing support. So we rolled that off to Swatch and the care coordination system in early January, and they've been taking it on ever since. They have several community health workers that, again, have multiple languages that are spoken, which is fantastic. And there's a couple of bugs in the system that we're working out with regard to the referrals, but as we refer people into the system, then Swatch picks it up, and they actually walk with that individual or that family during their isolation and quarantine period and then after for whatever those ongoing services that might be needed. And they are able to hook people into a variety of different, different services or supports that they might need. And so we're very excited that we were able to do that, and we're going to continue to work with Swatch to expand those services as time goes on. So those, I think that's all my updates on isolation and quarantine wraparound and call center. Do you guys have any questions? All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roxanne and Dr. Melnick. Those were really great. Great updates and a lot of important information in there. So we really appreciate it. So next thing that we have on our agenda, actually we didn't talk about the flu. Is there Dr. Melnick, would you just give us kind of where we're at today with this flu?
We're not even close to flu season. I think the percent of tests that are positive for flu needs to be 10% or above to be flu season, and we're like below. I think we're well below 1%. I actually have the numbers. Let me just look at my email here for a second. Had it out. I look like I'm distracted because I'm looking at the numbers. The last I looked, we're at like 0.0%. And nationally, it was at 0.3%. And in Washington State, it's been about 0%. So the bottom line is, there's an article in the CDC about this, but now we're into February already, and we haven't seen any flu, and that's really highly unusual when you look at past years. But the thinking is, we can't prove it because it's not a broad based. We call it an ecologic study. It's looking at entire populations here. But it looks like, the suspicion is that the mitigation measures that we've used for COVID-19, the masking and the physical distancing, I mean, flu spreads by droplets as well, that the mitigation measures we're using for COVID-19 have helped prevent us from having a flu season. At least that's some of the thinking on this. If there's any good news, the bad news is, every year flu in the United States kills between 30 and 50,000 people a year, whereas COVID-19 within a year has killed, 450,000 people. So a lot more lethal. It does exist. It's not a hoax. The trade-off is not a good trade-off, but at least we've had less flu this year. If any flu this year.
That's interesting and kind of not surprising considering how many people are being really careful. My husband and I have been commenting to that we've learned some things from this year that will serve us going into the future after COVID is over. This is the first that we've gone for a whole year without a cold, without any flu, without any infectious disease of any kind. It's been kind of interesting.
So. You live in a microbial soup or something, I guess, but yeah.
But we can do some things to protect ourselves. That's what we're discovering.
I mean, masks are very highly effective if they're used.
Yeah, I think we'll keep using them, I'm sure, in certain situations going on into the future, too. So the next thing that we have on the agenda is, Dr. Melnick, I think you're going to bring us an update on the election of the executive committee members.
Yeah, I think we can just announce this. So our slate was, for chair was Marla and for vice chair, Aru, and Sandy is a member at large. And we had 11 people voted. And all 11 folks who voted, which is a quorum, voted yes on the slate. So you three are voted in as our executive team. I felt like I could mention that with everybody being here.
Yeah. That's fine because everyone has already voted when we were, not aware. So that I think that's great, and I'm happy that I'll be working with the same folks again on the executive committee, and appreciate the support of FAC to allow us to continue for another term. So thank you, everyone. Does anybody else on the executive committee have any comment to make or anything you want to say?
This is Aru. Just wanted to say thank you, everyone, for your support, and it's been such a wonderful experience so far, and I'm really looking forward to continuing the work with everyone, so thank you.
I would agree. Thank you again for the support, and it's been great working with Marla and Aru, and I look forward to working with you again, and just being on the committee is an enjoyment for me as well. So I learn a lot every month, every time we meet.
Definitely, likewise. So on the agenda now, we have an opportunity for questions and answers. And I would also ask for, after that, we would normally do our updates. But so if there are any questions and answers, we'll take those now. And have a question, who would you like to address? To address the question, and go right ahead. I think I see.
This is Paul.
Yes, thank you.
I wanted to mention that I saw on MSNBC night before last an interview with a lady who works at the New York Times, and her position there is she is a cybersecurity reporter. And she came out with a book, which I just set off for, which is called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. And her name is Nicole Perlroth, P-E-R-L-R-O-T-H. And basically, that's been her expertise for the last several years, and she was saying that we have, of course, we're trying to be hacked by many nations around the world, but we also have people who are in the United States who are trying to hack us also. It may just be a single individual who gets on and gets into somebody's hacks into somebody's website or whatever, but this is happening all the time. Fortunately, we have the availability to catch these at some time, but just recently, and John, you might have heard about this, I don't know which small town it was, but there were, it's a small town of about 17,000 population, and someone hacked into their water control and affected the amount of chemicals that were to be used for the city's water. And this, fortunately, was caught by one of the people that was handling the water control devices and noticed it. But the big question is, sometimes, unfortunately, maybe people will not get a hold of it. So the name of the book, again, is This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, Nicole Perlroth. And it concerns all types of cybersecurity, which is going to be or is a major issue that we are running into in this day and time. Basically, that's about all I have to say about that. But that's that seems to be the one of the big issues today, and we it doesn't catch all the news these days, you know, with the pandemic and everything. But it's still out there, so we all have to be very careful. And we noticed that, of course, you know, big businesses like that have been hacked into, but when they start getting into our what we drink, things like that, this could be a major problem. Thank you.
I got one last point about COVID-19. When there's a chance, I'll mention that.
Well, I just want to say thank you, Paul, for bringing that up, because it is starting to become more talked about in the news, and I think it's something that we all have to pay attention to just on in our own little sphere, but it is real, and appreciate you bringing it up. So go ahead, Dr. Melnick, you had something.
Just an answer to Adrian's question. I just checked the CDC site, so it looks like the two vaccines produce antibodies that work against the South African variants, but you know, that just one, you know, indirect indication. The CDC is actually, they're studying these vaccines, so the jury is, I mean, it looks promising, but and direct, you know, but they're still doing studies on it.
Okay,
Talk
great.
About.
Thanks for following up.
So, anybody else have any questions and or updates that you'd like to share with our council?
Marla, this is Aru. I just wanted to add really quick, speaking of interesting items to share. So there was a great piece in the New Yorker, and I think it was last week, that talked about vaccine hesitancy among healthcare workers. Turns out not all healthcare workers are excited to get the vaccine. And this article really digs into why, and it has to do a lot with, you know, trust in our medical system. You know, CNAs, RNs, they're underpaid, unappreciated. They don't feel like the facilities they work for really care for them. So there's a lot of questions around, you know, how safe is this vaccine? They want me to take it, but when people feel like no one cares about it or cares about them, you know, they're hesitant to take the vaccine. So it's a really good piece that I think, it, you know, really exposes kind of the problems with our healthcare system and how that's really impacting COVID and vaccination rates, and particularly true in communities of color who, you know, have for so long been let down by our medical system. So just wanted to pass that along. It's in the New Yorker. It's a quick read, but it was really interesting to me to read that.
Thanks. Thank you for passing that along. It kind of reminds me of the fact that there's always been, in the last few years anyway, concern about burnout on the part of clinical providers of all many kinds. And certainly the pandemic has added many more reasons why people could be feeling very stressed and exhausted. And that those things also contribute to people's anxiety around something like a vaccine. So it's probably a maybe symptom of a bigger problem. But thank you. That's really important. I see Dr. Gross with a hand raised. Please feel free to join us.
Thank you. Amy Gross. I'm on the Commission on Aging, and I just wanted to announce that we're working on our work plan for 2021, which will be focused on how we can help older adults prepare for the next pandemic. What are the lessons learned from what's going on now, including some things you mentioned, people who don't have the bandwidth to get to make their appointments, people who can't, who don't drive to testing sites or vaccine sites. And there'll be, every month, there'll be some experts talking at our public meeting, which is the third Wednesday of every month at 4:30. Anyhow, we have a website, and I think it's going to be a very exciting year.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. That does sound good. Very good. Thank you. Other updates or questions?
I just have a quick question about, has there been any information or have you heard anything on any side effects of the vaccine? I hear a lot of people concerned about that, especially after the second dose, and how it varies from various populations. So I don't know if you have anything on that at all.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly have, you know, those local reaction, you know, pain, you know, as well as, you know, some people have had fever, chills, you know, headaches and all that. But from what I know so far,
The vaccine is really safe. Most of the effects in terms of the potentially really severe adverse effects, like with other vaccines, occur pretty quickly afterwards. So the risk of anaphylaxis, for example. But the vaccine, as far as I've read so far, is really, again, those two vaccines are very effective and they're very safe. So there's actually, it's interesting, CDC, first of all, there's a VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Reporting System, which actually counts virtually everything, even if you fall off a ladder after getting a vaccine, like a few days later. I'm serious. Everything goes in there. But the CDC has developed an app. I think it's called BeSafe or something like that. You can look it up where if you get the vaccine, you can actually download this app and you can, the CDC will check in with you every day to see what whether you've had any side effects. So you can get that and track it. But as far as I know, the vaccine, large clinical trials, as well as, we're having more experiencing it now. And, in terms of basic vaccinology, very few I'd have to really scratch my head to think about long-term effects from vaccines. Generally, if they're going to cause problems, they're going to be acute, as you already mentioned. And these vaccines look pretty good.
Jonah, I want to say that, when you get your vaccine, I've gotten my vaccine out at Ridgefield at the fairgrounds. You get the CDC paperwork, and on there is the link to that, the app for the CDC site. And I, signed up for it. And so for a week, I got a text message with three simple questions about side effects that goes into their, the national database about side effects. So I encourage people to read that, the CDC website paperwork. There's the Department of Health from Washington paperwork, and then there's also the additional paperwork from CDC. And that's where you'll find that vaccination reporting app, and it just goes on your phone and pretty slick. It takes 15 seconds to do it.
So, and does that start with your first shot, or yes, does it wait until you have both?
That starts with the first shot, and then, I have my appointment for my second shot next week, and I'm already logged into the system, and so it'll ask me those questions by text by an app on the phone.
Thank you for doing that, by the way, John.
It's
that's
slick,
great.
It's slick. It's slick as a whistle,
Hey, that's a great tip. Other comments? Questions? Hold an opportunity. We have experts here. Okay, I'm not hearing anything. We might have an early end to our meeting and gift of time then.
Marla, can I recognize one more person?
Sure, of course.
I just wanted to say, again, thank you to Dave Fuller and our partners at CRESA. They've been really, really helpful throughout this whole response, going back to early last year, and they continue to be a great partner at the table. I just want to recognize them and say thank you.
Oh, that's a great call out. Thank you for doing that. Thank you.
I'll second that. Thanks, Roxanne, for bringing that up.
Yeah. Yay.
Thank you for that. I've really enjoyed working with you guys and getting to know you better over the course of the year and over the year to come.
Thank you, Dave. Doreen, did you have something?
No, I was clapping for Dave.
Oh, I was clapping for Dave.
Yeah.
I have to learn the symbols and emoticons for Zoom. Anything else? Okay. Well, then I think it's time to close the meeting, and I will ask if someone would like to make a motion that we adjourn.
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Thank you, Remy and Aru. Well, we'll close the meeting now. Meeting is adjourned. Have a very good rest of the week, and look forward to seeing you all again next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.